One of the hardest things about preaching is that language is constantly changing, and so text that we may read clearly in translation often is not so clear when you start to dig a little bit. An illustration of this floating around online observes that 2,000 years from now, no one will know the difference between a butt dial and a booty call. If you don't know the difference, ask your kids. It gets worse when we start talking about money. Over even just the past 15 years, the exchange rate between the British pound and US dollar has ranged from a low of $1.08 per pound to a high of some $2.05 to the British pound. In our text today, we have as well two different currencies. We have talents and denarii, and we might easily be able to guess that 10,000 talents is more than 100 denarii from the context of the story as well as the size of the numbers. But it's a challenge for us to go further than that. And I am a pastor and not an engineer for good reason. I did not set out in my life to do math, but sometimes we just need to take the time. Starting, as Jesus does, with the larger debt, 10,000 talents. We should start by noting that at this time, 10,000 was the largest easily citable number. They had not yet had reason to come up with a word for larger quantities, as we have now decided that 1,000 thousands or 100 ten thousands is a million. In fact, the English word myriad that we use still to mean countless is derived from the same Greek word for 10,000. The talent as well was the largest unit of currency. If we read elsewhere in Matthew, we can get the idea that a talent is a large enough amount of money to be worth investing, as in Matthew 25, three slaves are giving 1, 2, and 5 talents to invest on behalf of their master. Through historical records, we can learn that the entire annual tax revenue for Herod the Great, a territory that comprises what is now much of the modern state of Israel and a decent piece of Syria, was 900 talents per year, less than a tenth of this debt forgiven by the king in the story. We can go further as well, because in this time, money was still attached to precious metals, and so another source can tell us that one talent is equal to roughly 45 pounds of silver. 10,000 talents then is nearly 500,000 pounds of silver, so at current prices, $150 million. Putting all of this together, Jesus talking about this first servant being forgiven 10,000 talents is sort of like Jesus saying a gajillion dollars, but with biblical gravitas. This means that this first wicked slave is no ordinary slave, and the king is no ordinary regional king. This is empire money. This is not a personal debt. This is one that could have only been accrued through massive mismanagement. This is an amount of money that the king surely knows can never be recovered. Any decision to sell the slave and his family and his possessions or to have the man tortured are purely punitive. This debt will never be made good. Now we come to the other debt, to 100 denarii. It is a tiny amount, relatively speaking. 6,000 denarii was a single talent. I know some of you may be doing the math yourselves. With that, the ratio is 100 talents is 1/600,000th of the debt otherwise forgiven, or 1/600,000th of 150 million comes out to some $250. But money is complicated, and there are other ways of determining the value of a denarius. It was also the standard daily wage. 100 denarii is then roughly 4 months' work. For contemporary terms, if we use the minimum wage in West Virginia of $8.75 an hour, 100 8-hour days is, before taxes, $7,000. This amount is not trivial, even if it seems that way in comparison to the larger debt. If we go from this calculation of a denarius, that puts the larger debt at some $4.2 billion today, assuming we've dropped the gold standard and use the relationship between the two units of currency. Matthew puts this story from Jesus into a frame that leads us to read this on forgiveness and on forgiving each other. It makes it easy for us to spiritualize the story, to stand at a distance from the text and to say, well, yes, I wouldn't be like that guy. If I just get $4 billion forgiven, I'm not going to quibble over $7,000. It makes it easy for us to think about these relative amounts, but I don't think we should read parables at only one level. That is not what makes them parables. So I want to try to paraphrase this story, to imagine it in a modern context. One day, the Government Accountability Office, the GAO in Washington, is going over the budget for various programs, and they come across one large program and see some discrepancies. Somehow it seemed as if the program's director had managed to lose, we'll say the smaller number, $150 million. They started to suspect that maybe this director was corrupt, had embezzled this money for himself, and this leads to a criminal investigation. The director is out publicly begging for mercy, and the investigation ultimately reveals that this was not corruption, just incompetence. This director had not stolen the money, had just been so bad at running the program that $150 million had disappeared. And so he was allowed to quietly resign, and this, being DC, moved into a nice large house in Northern Virginia, where he stayed when he wasn't out doing the lecture circuit. A little while later, after that initial news coverage has died down, he decides he wants to expand his home. Maybe he wants to put in a pool. And he hires a contractor who does the work, but after the job is done, this former program director looks through and sees that the contractor had accidentally overcharged him for $7,000 of materials. This program director sues the contractor, and the legal fees drove him into bankruptcy, putting this business out of business. A little while later, still, this program director decides to try to restart his political career, to run for Congress back in his hometown, and when the press find out about the story about his bankrupting a small local contractor after having been forgiven for mismanaging $150 million or $4 billion. The public outcry drives him from public life for good. This is not a story about any particular administration. It's not a story about any particular political party. I know about half of the room is imagining one set of names and the other half of the room is imagining another set of names, and that's fine, but stop. This isn't about red versus blue. This is an effort to help us understand what the scale of this story is. An effort to help us relate a little better. We may struggle to imagine being in a position of losing $4 billion or even just $150 million. But I think that we can imagine someone who feels like they lost everything and so is now trying to hold on a little too tightly to the things that are left. Even if the sums are too large for us to really imagine in this story, we can probably remember a time where we were looking at a loss in one part of our lives, and so we gripped too firmly in another. We can imagine feeling relief at being forgiven something, while also feeling shame at having done the wrong in the first place and transferring that on to someone else. We may remember a time in our own lives when we felt ashamed and so we blamed someone else. We may remember times in our lives where we found our own comfort by holding on to a grudge so tightly we could not see any good in a person who was trying to help us. If we take out Matthew's frame around this story and just focus on the words of Jesus, the text ends with the wicked servant being tortured. Ends with the wicked servant losing his chance at grace. Every parable is meant to be read at multiple levels, and no allegory is perfect. In this story, with Matthew's frame, we easily see the king as God, but the king in this story is still a tyrant. The king in this story's first instinct was to sell this servant and all of his family. We cannot then just stop with the king, with the slave squandering the mercy shown to just, we cannot just stop with this slave thrown away to be forgotten in torture forever. Because the king in this story is not in this way like God. We need to make one last turn. We need to remember the Lord's Prayer that we will say later today that carries the line for us Presbyterians, forgive our debts as we forgive our debtors. I want us to think about that sentence as we ask God's mercy each week to us to be contingent on our mercy toward others. If that is true for many of us, for probably all of us, for at the very least me, we would often end up just like the slave being tortured. Thankfully, God's grace to us is not contingent on our grace to other people. We are called not, we are called to model God's grace. We are called to forgive others as God forgives us, and as God will give us the strength to do. Amen.